This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Vacation, for many Americans, means time to sit on the beach, next to a pool, or even in the backyard and do as close to nothing as possible. Other people, though, are more active, and for them, vacation provides an opportunity to learn. Many this summer will stroll the streets of a colonial village or follow in the footsteps of pioneers along the Oregon Trail. Indeed, more and more Americans are trying to incorporate a history lesson into their summer break. Later on in this hour, some recent history as historians look into facts behind the legends surrounding the Black Panther Party. But first, we'll explore the topic of historical vacations and talk about which trips might fit your interest and your budget this summer. One of the things we'll talk about is living history, where people pay for full immersion among Civil War reenactors or medieval jousters or spend 2 weeks in a real prairie house. We're wondering what historical errors our emailers might think has been overlooked. London, the plague years, perhaps? Our email address is totn at npr.org. Again, that's totn at npr.org. If you're spending some of your vacation at historical sites this summer, call and tell us which bits of history you propose to explore, or maybe you have a recommendation for some time or place that you have been in the past. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn at npr.org. Joining us now is Mark Orwall. He's managing editor of Travel and Leisure magazine. And also with us is Keith Bellows, editor-in-chief of the National Geographic's Traveler magazine. And they're both with us from NPR's bureau in New York. Mark Orwall, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And Keith Bellows, good to talk to you as well.
Hi there, Neil.
Keith, first of all, just about every vacation at some point along the way, you know, mom or dad is going to say, the kids are driving me crazy. Why don't we go check out that old fort?
Yeah, you could say that. The interesting thing about a historic vacation, though, is you want something not only for mom and dad, but for the kids themselves. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing a lot more movement toward interactive museum fixtures and so on and so forth, so that everybody can get a rewarding experience.
So it's not just a respite from a rainy day at the beach. It's something you plan the whole thing around.
Yeah, I think so. And it sure hasn't been a respite for me when I've taken my 16-year-old on the road.
Mark, what about you? What do you think?
Well, people are more interested in historic vacations, I think, today than ever. But the fact is this really needs some definition, because a historic vacation could mean something as simple as staying at a historic hotel. Mm-hmm. It can mean something as intense as going to, as you said in your introduction, seeing reenactors recreating a famous battle, or even taking part yourself, and anything in between those two extremes.
Well, that seems to, you know, gather in a whole lot of territory then.
Oh, it certainly does, which is why when we talk about historic travel, it's almost like when people used to refer to public television as educational TV. It was a real turnoff. And I almost think that the phrase historical travel can be a bit of a turnoff. It sounds like a third period history class mm-hmm. in high school.
Yeah, the field trip. You know,
exactly.
Keith, one thing that helps is a prepared mind. People are doing more research, do you think, to get prepared to see what they're going to see?
I really think, and if they don't, they should. I think there's a sort of tendency, especially among American travelers, that they'll pick up a guidebook wherever they want to go, and they'll read the guidebook, and that's basically where it stops. But the richness of what you may experience can be heightened if, for instance, you pick up a novel, you pick up an historic novel on some place you want to go, and so you get a much more dimensionalized sense of what you're going to see. So that isn't just here's this monument, here's this battlefield. You understand the story that took place there.
Mm-hmm. So if, for example, you were going to go to Gettysburg, it might help if you read The Killer Angels.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Mark, history is not confined merely to the North American continent.
Well, no, it's not. But, I mean, in fact, the North American continent probably has less than almost any other continent you can mention.
Antarctica. I'm going to throw Antarctica
in there. Okay,
all
right. You got me there. You got me there. But I want to actually jump on something that Keith was referring to a second ago about in terms of the research and the preparation. You know, I took my kids on a trip to, I have children 13, 11, and 9. My wife and I took them to Ireland just a couple years ago. And I was reading guidebooks to them, and I was trying to find age-appropriate magazine articles for them. And, you know, they yawned in such a way that it was a frightening thing to behold. What I finally ended up doing was bringing home some travel videos from our local library, just checked them out. And, you know, although we don't like to admit it, the culture of teens and preteens today is pretty much built around television. And these kids really glommed onto it right away, seeing the pictures, seeing the video, hearing and seeing interviews with local people. They really got excited about the trip. And I think that's something that parents can use as a tool to get kids really prepared for a historical vacation or any other kind, actually.
And I actually could also, playing off that, I mean, the internet is a great tool for this. And in fact, when my son and I and wife went to Greece, I insisted that he spend a certain amount of time researching online the islands that he wanted to see. I wanted him to know a little bit about the Acropolis before he took off. And he really had to demonstrate this for me because I didn't want him to go there cold.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Call and let us know where you have been that you think of is of historical interest that you would recommend and where you might be going this summer. Our first caller is Zeke, who joins us on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have had some vacations to some of the living museums in the Boston area. During my high school days, I spent a week living in Sturbridge Village and really found that fascinating. I enjoyed my time there. And, of course, I've been to Plymouth Plantation and spent a great deal of time there, but never a whole week.
When you were in Sturbridge, you were one of the characters in costume and living this all out in Sturbridge Village?
Yes, I was. I operated a Franklin Press because I was studying printing as one of the things that I was learning in high school.
And obviously you found it fascinating, but boy, it's hard work, isn't it?
It's incredibly hard work, and it's incredibly hard work to live the entire life that they lived back in the early 1800s.
Rising with the dawn, and evenings are quite a bit shorter than they are.
Much shorter and a lot of work involved. Always work, because we had to not only work at the printing press, but we also work to feed ourselves and keep our food on the plate.
So, it's interesting to live it for a week. Having been there for a week, you still like your TV set?
Much better than the TV set, and I do like my TV set, but I'd much rather live that type of life. It really was much more rewarding to just live life to the fullest. I mean, there was no grocery store to go to. We had to barter for vegetables and such. It was great fun.
Well, Mark Orwell, are these kinds of vacations becoming more popular?
Well, actually, what Zeke was describing is certainly more on the extreme end of things. For example, at Old Sturbridge Village or Plymouth Plantation or any of the other living history museums in the Northeast and throughout the country, I think most people would prefer to actually just attend as guests and soak up the atmosphere for a day or two. I admire Zeke. It doesn't sound like a vacation to me, but
it was a great experience. But what I would love to see come in the future is to go deeper into the past. Like, I would truly love to spend some time learning about pre-Columbian history here in America and really go out and see how the Native Americans lived and really live with them for a while.
Perhaps somebody will set that up for you, Zeke, and you can go spend a week in pre-Columbian history.
I would love to do it. And one day I pray to spend some time with the Inuits and really see how they live their lives.
So you are after adventurous vacations, aren't you?
I'm a mountaineer from days gone by, and I would really love to live deep adventure.
Okay. When you got back, by the way, from Sturbridge Village after a week, was there one modern convenience to which you would say, thank you? Was it what? And if it was, what was it?
It was having instant food, being able to get fed quickly at a restaurant and such, as opposed to grinding your own grain and leavening your own bread and all. That was a lot of work.
Okay, Zeke, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And have a great vacation.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Nicole, and Nicole's with us from Buffalo, Minnesota.
Hello.
Hello.
And I'm just calling to tell you about probably one of the best museums our family has ever been to, and that's the Jorvik Viking Center in York, England.
And what made it so great?
Well, it's really neat. It's a Viking museum, but it comes complete with smells.
That's normally not considered an attraction. What made it so in this case?
Well, you know, it was really fascinating. It had setups of all the different things that the Vikings did in York, buildings and whatnot, but it also had cooking smells of what the huts smelled like, things like that.
And this was an exhibit where you went around and there were people doing this?
Yes.
So it was like a living history kind of a thing, but you were just there as a visitor, not as a not as a Viking.
Yes.
I hear
we
some.
Were just there. Oh, that's my son. We were just there visiting.
Some baby Vikings there in the background. Yeah.
Yeah.
as I'm sure you recalled, York was where near there the battle that King Harold fought just before the his ill-considered battle that further south against the Normans in Hastings.
Yes.
So he won a great victory there, but nobody remembers that because he lost the next one.
Yeah. Well, it happened.
Can't win them all, I guess.
Yeah.
Nicole, thanks very much for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's, before the break, see if we can talk to Danny, who's in Syracuse, New York.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great to be on and get through.
Okay.
We've had many different experiences with this sort of historical vacationing. I'll just mention a couple of them. Stonehenge in England, it was pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
It's just neat to see those monoliths there and just think that thousands of years ago people were doing their thing there. One of the most intriguing things I did was climbing a bell tower in Germany and finding a graffiti that said MAC, M-A-C, 1710. Somebody scrawled their name into the bell tower of this cathedral in Freiburg, Germany. And that was pretty amazing.
I guess graffiti is older than we think it is.
Yeah, you never know. And one other experience was I took my kids last summer to Mount Rushmore, and it was fogged in. You couldn't even see the mountain. I had to take a picture of them next to the soda machine that had a picture of Mount Rushmore on it in order to prove that we had been there.
Well, Danny, where are you going this summer?
Well, we're probably going out to visit my sister-in-law and her newly adopted baby in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. So we'll probably stop at some sites of interest along the way.
Well, have a great time.
Well, thanks. It's been great to be on your show.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be eating, by the way, some indigenous foods along the way. I tried to call in the other day when you had that program going on.
With Calvin Trillin. So, well,
yes.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't able to get through. I had all sorts of stories on that, too.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Danny.
Bye.
Keith, just before we leave for a break, he did mention Stonehenge, but that's been set up now with a big visitor center. It's hard to get to the actual Stonehenge, isn't it?
It has been for a long time, but in fact, the British have just announced plans to completely redesign that site so you'll have better access, better visitor support system, and really get to see Stonehenge itself a little bit more easily than you can right now.
Right now, it's sort of like a life-size cardboard replica of Stonehenge.
It is. It's very difficult to get really up close and personal with it.
We're going to be taking more of your calls when we come back from a break. We're talking about historical vacations. And by the way, if there are eras in history that living history museums have overlooked, you suspect, why don't you send us an email, totn@npr.org. totn@npr.org. Our regular phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing historic vacations. Our guests are Mark Orwald, the managing editor of Travel and Leisure magazine, and Keith Bellows, editor-in-chief of National Geographic's Traveler magazine. We're also taking your questions and suggestions about historical travel. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Mark Orwald, there are a lot of vacations that most of us plan. I mean, Danny was just talking about driving to visit his sister and her new child. That obviously doesn't need the help necessarily of a professional. Some vacations, though, do.
Well, they do, but, you know, I am not necessarily a big fan of guided tours or escorted tours, not just for myself, but for most people. I think, as Keith Bellows mentioned a few minutes ago, the wealth of material that is available to any traveler or would-be traveler is enormous. And if you want to put in just a little bit of research, you can customize your own vacation to the extent that there won't be a minute of boredom. I mean, there will be something for everybody every day because you've planned out your trip according to your family's interests. And it's so easy, so much easier to do today than it ever has been.
Let's get a caller in, and Rachel joins us from Brookings in South Dakota.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a suggestion for people to find out their own personal history of their ancestors and things like that. My family and I have done this twice now. My great-great-grandfather, S.V. Jones, was on John Wesley Powell's second expedition through the Grand Canyon. And so we sort of followed his footsteps from Green River, Wyoming, to the Grand Canyon and went rafting through the Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
Not everybody has had that type of person in their family, but I just think that, you know, we all have people in our family that have done interesting things, and maybe if we can do research to find out what our family members have done and then maybe have a historical trip that way.
Well, Keith Bellows, are people combining this sort of historical interest and the genealogical rage that's been going on, what, for 20 years and more?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen an explosion in sort of tracing and retracing your family history. And it doesn't even just have to be directly your family. For instance, my mother grew up in London during the Blitz, and one of the most fascinating things you can see, one of the great, I think, historic sites in London are the war rooms, which where Churchill conducted his war plans. There's the map room, there's where he slept, and they've just expanded it, in fact, to increase the size of it. But it is fascinating, and it gave me a much greater sense of what my mother experienced during the war.
Well, Rachel, would you have ever gone to the Grand Canyon had it not been for your ancestor?
Well, since it, you know, is a pretty big place and pretty popular, I probably would have, but I think it made it that much more special. We have a copy of his diary that he took on, and this was in 1870. So I think it made it that much more special to really understand that so many years ago, somebody in my family was there and experiencing these things.
Now, a lot of people get that same kind of feeling at Ellis Island, where so many Americans, American families arrived in this country.
Right, right.
All right, Rachel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Right.
As she mentioned, historical places are important to a lot of people. One of the most popular is Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia. Joining us now is Rex Ellis. He's vice president of the historic area in Colonial Williamsburg. He's on the phone with us from his office. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, sir.
For listeners who might be unfamiliar with Colonial Williamsburg, can you talk a little bit about its history and what vacationers might expect when they travel there now?
Well, Colonial Williamsburg was called the capital of the Old Dominion. It was really the first capital of the colonial colonies, the 13 colonies, and it was the place, the sort of seat of government. And so what we talk about is the roads and the places and the spaces where Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Patrick Henry and the sort of founding fathers visited and came to talk and to debate.
So this is a living history presentation, so people actually meet those people, or some of them.
They actually meet Mr. Jefferson, and they actually meet Patrick Henry and other citizens of the town.
What kind of training do the workers have to take to maintain the historical authenticity of their characters? Can't be easy being Thomas Jefferson.
It can't be easy at all. Some of the characters, like Thomas Jefferson and some of the others, which generally represent a minority, actually, are left a great deal of information behind, so that we have a lot of diaries and a lot of accounts and a lot of things that were written by them. Many of the others don't have the same kind of comprehensive information, and we feel it's just as important to talk about them as well as particularly those who were enslaved. We talk about that. We talk about Native Americans as well. And so what we try to do is to sort of give a diverse presentation of the variety of people who were here. But most of the training takes anywhere from, well, it could be 3 months to begin the process. But, for instance, our Thomas Jefferson has been working on his character for the last 10 years. And so the longer you do the character, the more interactions you present, and the more personas that the more times that you present those personas, the better it is, and the more you understand and know the character, and the greater your presentation can be.
Obviously, some of the great debates in American history were staged there in Williamsburg. Do we get to listen in?
You do get to listen in a variety of places. Sometimes we have those debates at the governor's palace. Sometimes we have them at the Capitol during an assembly meeting. But we generally not only try to do those debates, but we try to get our audiences involved in the debates as well.
Well, Rex Ellis, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Rex Ellis is vice president of the historic area in Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia, and he joined us by phone from his office there. Still with us are Keith Bellows, editor-in-chief of National Geographic's Traveler magazine, and Mark Orwald, who's managing editor of Travel and Leisure magazine. And why don't we take some more of your calls? Our next caller is Chuck, who's with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi. You had a call earlier talking about Vikings. I actually spend a week in August living medieval history with 13,000 other souls in a medieval tent city for an event called the Penzic War. There's nothing like putting on 65 pounds of armor and going out in the 90-degree sun to have a battle with 2,000 other soldiers to really get a feel for what medieval life was all about.
What's your favorite implement of destruction?
Oh, I have several. Archery is big, and also I have this big 7-foot-long pole axe that I whack people with. So it definitely gets your aggressions out, and then the evenings are all full of reveling and merriment and feasting and big canvas pavilions and torches and campfires and all. It really does make for a break from the mundane life.
It's quite different from the cubicle existence. I don't know what you do for a living, but you must think about that big, long pole axe every once in a while at a staff meeting.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have a few of my weapons up in the walls in the office, so when people come in and they wonder what the weaponry is all about next to the laptop, it makes for some interesting conversation as well.
Well, I wanted to read you an email we got from Art Walker in Stanford, or at Stanford University, who says, I didn't create it, but I can't remember where he heard it, thus can't attribute the below. A guy signs up for an historical vacation on the Mediterranean and finds himself chained to an oar in a galley among scores of other men in backbreaking work, rowing to the steady beat of a drum, whipped when slacking or even speaking to each other, under the decking day after day for many weeks, not at all what he was led to believe. Finally, the day comes, the galley pulls into a harbor for the last time, a man comes down from the deck with a ring of keys and row by row unlocks the shackles, freeing the rowers. The man turns to his oar mate and asks jokingly, do you think we should tip the drummer? The other man responds, I did last year.
That's great. One of those things that, why do you do it? Well, it feels so good when you stop.
Exactly. You must feel awfully light going into the office without all that armor on.
Right. Yeah, it's good. Good conditioning, and it's a good group of friends. I'm in my 40s, and I've been doing this since I was a freshman in college. So a lot of it is just continuity, that there are people that I've known for 20 or 30 years that I only see once a year at this event. There are people come from all over the world, literally. There, people will fly in from Australia with bagfuls of armor and weapons and trying to get through airport security with various implements of destruction is a lot tougher now than it used to be.
Well, Chuck, thanks very much for the call, and you're off again for your joust?
Yes, it's in August. The group is called the Society for Creative Anachronism. The event is called the Penzic War. It's in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, every August.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And Mark Orwell, obviously we're getting a lot of calls from these, and I've heard of, actually, the Society for Creative Anachronism.
Oh, it's one of the most popular of the reenactor sort of groups, but you're going to find them for virtually every period in American history. I know the Civil War is one of the most popular eras for reenactors. In fact, July 4th, coming up very soon, there's going to be the reenactment of the Battle of Gettysburg over the course of 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
The Revolutionary War is another very popular one. And by the way, Neil, I just have to congratulate you on the diversity of your listeners there. These people are just great. They have some wonderful ideas. I don't want to travel with them, but they're unnecessarily. But they have some great ideas.
Well, let's see what Jamis is up to. Jamis calls us from Woodside, California.
Hi. The world of reenacting is surprising. It's all over the world. Last year, I went to Poland because in Germany, it's verboten to reenact the recent wars. But so they all run over to Poland, and in Darlow, Poland, on the coast, thousands of people dress up as German soldiers, Americans, Russians, Poles, English, and drive around for days in tanks, drinking beer and wearing camouflage makeup. It's been going on for years, too. It's nothing to see guys walking around holding machine guns in little Polish villages driving half tracks.
You might think it's even now, it's a little too soon for that.
Yeah, and then another activity that they have in Poland is they have the Friends of the American Crow Indian Society, and they have several thousand people that have powwows every summer, skinheads, young people with tattoos and war paint.
And do any American Crow Indians have anything to do with this at all?
Well, historically, there was a Crow Indian woman that ended up in Poland in the 1840s, and it all came from that.
I see.
The American Crows aren't, I don't think they're going over to Poland.
This might lack some authenticity, is what you're suggesting.
I guess so, exactly.
Well, Jamis, thanks very much. I was intrigued to hear, did you take part in this World War II reenactment?
Well, I went on a tank buying trip with a friend of mine who's got the world's largest army tank collection in private hands. He's got about 89 tanks now.
So he's missing a Mark IV Panzer or something?
Everyone's missing a Mark IV Panzer.
Well, some of us... anyway.
There's always hope.
There's always hope. Did you find the tank you were looking for?
Well, I think he got a couple amphibious vehicles and some cannons. You always have to buy something.
Yeah, you can't come home empty-handed.
No, it would be just rude.
And he must have had an interesting time at LaGuardia.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Appreciate the phone call. Keith Bellows, people are obviously crazy.
Well, you could say that, or they crave the authentic. And I think that this is one of the things that's changed a lot in travel in the last 5 or 10 years. It used to be that people would be sort of satisfied with a passive experience, and now I think they want something more experiential, and they really want that authentic experience. And the more they can recreate what it was like in the past, the happier they'll be. And we're seeing some extremes in that, but it's pretty fascinating.
And Neil, if I can interject, I think the last gentleman brought up some really interesting points, but it leads me to think about the subject of sensitivity. First off, you know, there could certainly be a significant portion of Poland that might object to seeing Nazis driving around in tanks down their street for obvious reasons. But I'm sorry we weren't able to have Rex Ellis on just a little bit longer from Colonial Williamsburg. You know, since 1979, Colonial Williamsburg has made a very good and sincere effort to bring people of color into the whole presentation mm-hmm. at Colonial Williamsburg. One of the interesting things, though, that I just read an article about this. It was written 5 years ago by a professor at Bowling Green, a guy named Christopher Geist, and he points out that apparently the a number of the white guests at Colonial Williamsburg, while they were willing to sort of adapt to their role-playing experience with the people like Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson, they were extremely uneasy at playing their role when encountering the reenactors who were portraying slaves.
Hmm.
And quite clearly, the reason being that they did not want to act like they were potential slave owners. So the issues of sensitivity that go hand in hand with these reenacting and living history museums it's a really touchy issue and one that we've only had to deal with, I think, in the last 10 or 20 years.
Our guests are Mark Orwall and Keith Bellows. We're talking about historical vacations. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. And Ben joins us on the line from Sutherland, Iowa.
Hi. So I'm calling just to give a recommendation, and it's a biased recommendation because it's in the town where I grew up. and it's to visit the Mystic Seaport in Mystic, Connecticut.
Mystic Seaport was the home of, well, I guess part of the whaling industry, and now there's a lot of stuff that goes on in Mystic, including the Institute for Exploration. Bob Ballard has a museum there.
Right, and it has a, I believe, the only wooden whaling ship left in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a kid, I loved going there and playing on the ship and playing at the Children's Museum.
New London, not too far away. That's, of course, where the Submarine Museum is.
Yep,
okay.
Or right across the river, but close.
Ben,
and,
one more thing about Mystic, then we got to go.
Okay, so let me see. It was great as a kid, and then even now as an adult, I love going back. So a lot of different experiences.
Okay, Ben, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Wayne, who's in Milwaukee.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You've been talking about like week-long experiences and that kind of thing, but I'm in Wisconsin here, and I'm a reenactor myself. I do the fur trade era from 1750 to 1840, and there is a lot of weekend rendezvous reenactments that a person can go to for a day and walk around in small towns that are around, and some get quite large, and you go from tent to tent, and people have things set up the way they did it, cooking, camping. There's tomahawk throwing, knife throwing, some archery, black powder gun shooting. The people are all very knowledgeable on what's going on, and you know, to instead of doing like a whole week kind of thing, you could do just a weekend or like a day trip kind of thing.
Well, thanks for the suggestion.
But
Keith Bellows, quickly, where are you going to vacation this summer?
Well, I'm going to stay home for a little while, and then I'm headed off to China.
And Mark Orwell, where are you going?
Well, we're actually going to Colonial Williamsburg with my family, my wife and three kids, and then we're looking for a beach someplace. So if anybody has a great recommendation, I'm open to all ideas.
So, Keith, are you doing the Great Wall or going more somewhere even more exotic?
We're definitely doing the Great Wall. We're going to Beijing. Obviously, we want to wait until the SARS situation calms down, and that's why we're still not quite sure whether that's where we're headed off. But and, of course, we'll be doing some trips closer to home. I'm from Montreal, so I always try to get back there, and there's a lot of history there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both. Mark Orwell, Managing Editor of Travel and Leisure Magazine. Appreciate your time today.
Delighted, Neil. Thank you.
And also Keith Bellows, Editor-in-Chief of National Geographic's Traveler Magazine. Appreciate
you
being
with
us. Okay. They were both with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a short break, we're going to take an historical look back at the Black Panther Party. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.